WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After serving as the Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine, Matt Bynum-Reese has written a new detective novel about Palestinian gunmen who have made themselves the law and a Christian accused of collaborating with the Israelis. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Reese about the actual events that inspired the novel. Also, on TV, he's best known for playing Jennifer Garner's father in Alias and for his starring role in Justice. On stage, he was in the original productions of Sondheim's Sweeney Todd and Assassins. We'll talk with Victor Garber about his stage and screen career and the revival of Sondheim's Follies that he just starred in. It was staged by the City Center Encore series in New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After covering the Middle East as Time's Jerusalem bureau chief from 2000 to 2006, my guest Matt Bynan-Reese has started a mystery series about a Palestinian history teacher turned detective. The first book in the series has just been published. It's called The Collaborator of Jerusalem. The story is set in motion when the teacher's good friend and former student, who is a Christian Palestinian, is accused of collaborating with the Israelis in the killing of a Palestinian guerrilla. The teacher is certain his friend is innocent and sets out to prove it. The book explores divisions within Palestinian culture. Reese explored divisions within Israeli as well as Palestinian culture in his nonfiction book, Cain's Field, Faith, Fratricide, and Fear in the Middle East. Let's start with a reading from The Collaborator of Jerusalem. The Palestinian accused of collaborating is talking to his former teacher.
In your class on the Arab Revolt of 1936, you said that the so-called Arab heroes were really just gangs. They went around robbing villages of their food and killing those who resisted, and all the time no one could take them on because these killers were portrayed as the brave men standing up against the Zionists and the army. They ended up killing more Palestinians than Jewish farmers or British soldiers. You said that if the people had stood up to them early on, the gangs would have backed down and there could have been peace. The criminals have made themselves the law. They shoot at some soldiers and it transforms them into the representatives of the national struggle. That makes them unassailable, and they can abuse anyone they want, particularly Christians who are weak already. That was my mistake. I didn't see that clearly enough, but I don't regret it.
Is this not only your character's view, but is this your view too?
Yes, I think having covered in particular the Intifada, which began in 2000, the violence there and the way that broke down really convinced me that, what's most important in terms of amongst the Palestinians is the way in which these gangs of gunmen relate to the ruling political parties and to the government itself, the Palestinian Authority. Essentially, as that reading that I just gave you demonstrates, inside, let's say, just Bethlehem, but I think this applies to most Palestinian towns, as long as those gunmen attacked and sometimes killed Israelis, they were able then to essentially rule as gangsters over the Palestinian towns, particularly taking advantage of groups that didn't have the same kind of power, the Christians in Bethlehem, for example. The gunmen in Bethlehem were nominally part of Yasser Arafat's Fatah party, but they were also outsiders. They came from a village just outside Bethlehem, so they weren't part of the Bethlehem community, and therefore they didn't have any qualms about running protection rackets and other kind of criminal activity. And so that struck me as being what really drove the fighting on the edge of Bethlehem and Jerusalem, which to the foreign media might have looked like it was, the essence of the Intifada, the Israelis fighting against the Palestinians. But I realized that really there's no such thing as the Palestinians. There's so many groups and so many interests. And what I wanted to try and express in this novel is the views of the people that I had met and admired amongst the Palestinians who wanted to have law and order and peace and didn't want their entire society to be surrendered to this kind of gun law.
The way the story goes in your book, some of these gunmen also control the auto shop business in Bethlehem. Do you see the gunmen as basically being like organized crime?
In many ways, they really did become like that, particularly during the Intifada. The central government, which is, of course, represented in my novel by the police chief, a friend of the main character, lost all its power, really, because the way in which the Palestinian Authority was set up was really not a government as we would know it, but actually a system of patronage. Arafat was the center of it all because he controlled all the money, which, of course, many years later, foreign donors wondered where it had all gone. Well, it went to funding this this method that he had always had over the decades, but which he brought with him from exile, which was to hand out cash to local bosses who would then dependent upon him. in the Intifada, that got out of his control somewhat, because some of these local bosses realized that if they were allowed to fight against the Israelis, then they could use that, the kudos that gave them on a local level, to run separate rackets and get more money out of the locals.
You also describe in your novel how Christians have become easy targets in places like Bethlehem because they're now minorities. And in your novel, it's a Christian who's accused of being a collaborator with the Israelis. What evidence have you seen that Christians have become targets in Palestinian communities?
First of all, the Christian minority, not only because of the large birth rate of the Muslim Palestinians, has been declining. Bethlehem is now, at best, 20% Christian Arab. Those Christians are leaving in large numbers, particularly again during the violence of the Intifada, because they tend to be slightly better off economically and perhaps also better educated than the local Muslims, who are mainly refugees, very poor refugees. And so they've gone into exile in droves to the United States, but also to South America. There have been attacks against Christians, but mostly it's a sense of separation between the two societies. When I first came here, there were still a lot of connections between those two communities, but the Muslims during the Intifada became very suspicious of the Christians. They thought perhaps there were links to the West which made them easier to exploit by the Israelis as collaborators, and also that simply made them not as committed to the struggle of the Intifada as the Muslims were. And so those communities separated very much.
Your novel is inspired by events in 2003 during the Second Intifada. Last year, Hamas was the victor in the Palestinian elections. Do you see Hamas as functioning as gangs in the same way that you see Fatah as functioning as gangs?
No, Hamas has always set itself up in a different way from Fatah. It's never been a system of gangs and patronage in the same way that Fatah was. Although, again, what we're seeing lately is that it is also dependent for its operations on money in the same way that Fatah is. But I think one of the things that has happened in the last few years, as Hamas has come closer to the center of power and has even gone into government, is that there's a pressure on the organization itself from the differences of opinion between those who are in the government, who might want to deal with Fatah and certainly with foreign countries, and maybe even with Israel in a very distanced kind of way, and those committed to continuing the fight at the ground roots of the organization. There's been a lot of conflict, for example, from pressure from below to attack American targets, for example, which Hamas has always said they didn't want to do. Their struggle is against Israel. Now that, again, has led to a breakdown within Hamas to a certain extent, which makes it harder even for Hamas to control certain of its operatives in Gaza when there are conflicts with Fatah. And that's why in the agreement that was made recently between the leaders of Fatah and the leaders of Hamas in Mecca, one of the things that was much clearer there was that it was hard for any of those leaders on either side to really keep their organization in line. And that's why they were prepared to go as far as they were in that agreement.
Hamas and Fatah entered into a power-sharing agreement brokered by the Saudis, but Hamas and Fatah were fighting each other during parts of January and February. What is the fighting between them about besides power? Is it just about power?
Well, it's also about money for several reasons. One reason is that the Fatah gunmen, as soon as Fatah was out of the government, were cut off from the money that they used to get from Arafat, and even subsequently from the Fatah organization, even after Arafat's death. After Arafat's death, it did cut off somewhat because the current president, Abu Mazen, decided he was going to cut back and try and keep the gunmen in order. Now, on Hamas's side, it's also about money, because since they became in government, the international community has tried to prevent financial contacts. It's cut off aid to the Palestinian Authority, at least aid insofar as it goes through the Hamas government. And so what Hamas is trying to do by having this agreement with Fatah and somewhat ceding power to Fatah is to get that money flowing again. And it should also be noted that one of the reasons that that the Saudis wanted to do the deal is because if the European Union, the United States, was not going to be funding the Palestinian Authority, it was becoming increasingly clear that Iran was going to do it. And there's certainly one thing that the Saudis don't want in this area, this center of Middle Eastern conflict where the Palestinians are, is for the Iranians to have even more power over the situation than they already do.
If it weren't for the Saudis brokering this deal, this power-sharing deal, do you think that the Palestinians would have ended up in a civil war?
I think they were well into a civil war, actually. They don't have tanks, and they're not going to stand on one side of the sand dunes, you know, with an army that we would recognize as a real war. But they had started a civil war, and I think that's why they realized how imperative it was that they do some kind of deal. They had certainly started a civil war in Gaza, in the West Bank, simply because of the geography. The towns are pretty much cut off from each other by Israeli forces. But in Gaza, where they have much more freedom to operate, they really were into a civil war, and it could very easily have escalated to the stage where Fatah lost and was simply kicked out of Gaza, or where the American money might have counted and perhaps Hamas would be driven underground. So yes, they were in a civil war, and that was what was pushing them to this agreement in Mecca.
My guest is journalist and novelist Matt Bynum-Rees. His new mystery is called The Collaborator of Bethlehem. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Matt Bynum-Rees, and his new novel is called The Collaborator of Bethlehem, and it's based on his experiences as a Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine. He lives in Jerusalem and now is a contributor to Time magazine. In a note that precedes the beginning of your book, you write that all the crimes in the book are based on real events in Bethlehem. The killers really killed this way. Tell us about one of the killings in your book that's based on a real incident that you reported on.
Well, the first death is of a Fatah activist in a village called Irtas, and he was coming home. The reason that it sparks what happens here in the book is because it was done with the help of a Palestinian collaborator. What happened is that this man was creeping home in the twilight for the Ramadan iftar, the breakfast, at the end of the day of fasting. And he was shot by an Israeli sniper from up on the hill nearby. Now, what the Israelis did at that time during the Intifada was they would have a collaborator, a Palestinian, go up very close to the target so that they could identify him, so they wouldn't just shoot someone who happened to be walking along there at that time. And so a collaborator had gone up close, had identified to make sure that this was the right man, had then given a signal to the Israelis, and they had shot him. That started me to think about what would happen to those people who are thought of as collaborators and maybe even discovered as collaborators, because, of course, in Bethlehem, during the Intifada, there were instances of collaborators being killed, or people who were thought to be collaborators were killed and dragged through Manger Square right in the center of town by the Church of the Nativity. But one of the things that shocked me when I first discovered it was that sometimes the gunman would kill someone who they knew wasn't a collaborator, but they would then say that he was a collaborator because they couldn't find out who the real collaborators were, but they wanted to scare the collaborators so that they would stop collaborating.
What's the payoff for being a collaborator?
It's very small, actually, and that's one of the really pitiful things about the situation, is that sometimes someone might be a collaborator simply because the Israelis say, we'll give you a permit for your mother to go to hospital for the treatment she needs. Sometimes it's a very small amount of money, really a pifflingly small amount of money, $20, $30. Very often it begins with something where if you're the collaborator, you think, this doesn't do anyone any harm. You know, they're asking me for something very inoffensive. But as soon as you give them that information, you've started on a road which ends up perhaps with you being asked to identify someone who's going to get killed. So the collaborators get sucked in that way. It's one of the differences between how the Israelis have been able to run their operations, intelligence operations, inside the West Bank towns and inside the cells of Fatah and even of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. It's an advantage the Israelis have had, which the Americans don't have in Iraq, for example, in dealing with the insurgency there.
Your novel, The Collaborator of Bethlehem, is basically a detective novel, and the main character in it is very disillusioned with the Palestinians in power and with the Palestinian gunmen on the streets. And, you know, he thinks that the criminals have made themselves into the law, but they have this kind of righteous banner behind them because they also see themselves as freedom fighters against Israel. Have you met a lot of disenchanted Palestinians who feel similarly to the main character in your book?
Yes, I have. The main character is actually based on a very good friend of mine who inspired me, if you like, to explore this part of Palestinian thinking, because he was such a decent man. He was an independent thinker in an environment which is not conducive to independent thinking, you know, because you have men who do not want you to think independently, who are armed all around you. And I became very close with him over the years of the Intifada. He took me around Dehesha refugee camp. He really introduced me to people who are, I would say, challenging the gunmen very much of their city, however. They're not people who would ever leave, no matter how discontented they might be with the way things are in their hometown. They would never go and live in America or go and live in South America as others have done. They're very attached to it, and that's what gives them their validity in a way. I also became very friendly with people in the Palestinian Authority security services who are, let's say, in the second tier. They're not running each of the security services, because those tend to be very political figures. They're actually men who were in exile with Arafat over many decades and came back thinking they were going to be policemen and ended up with this kind of dirty game going on, where sometimes they were supposed to arrest bombers, other times they were supposed to let them go. And they became very discontented, and over the years told me a lot of interesting stories about what it was really like in the Palestinian security forces and, of course, in society. So they too were men that I admired very much and felt that their voices were not ever heard. They didn't talk to any other foreign correspondents. And that was what I wanted to get across, not just the stories that they told me, but the essence of their personality, which I hope comes across in the novel.
Israel basically isn't much in the equation in your novel. It's really about disagreements between Palestinians. Israel kind of sets up the story because one of the characters is accused of being a collaborator with Israel. So there's plenty of hostility to Israel within the larger story. But the disagreements are with between Palestinians, and, you know, the killings are between Palestinians. Why did you make that decision to have the novel about be about conflict between Palestinians as opposed to Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
As soon as I see Israelis and Palestinians on the same page, these cliches just jump out at me. And I wanted to make sure that there would be nothing like that in my book. I feel like this also reflects, in some ways, the reality of Palestinians now, because they're not allowed to move around from town to town in the West Bank. They don't, and there are no Israelis in the Gaza Strip. So they don't actually see Israelis very much these days. What exercises them is what happens inside their own town, because they can't go anywhere else. And so the way in which the gunmen work, their government or Hamas, whatever is going on in their own town, it really becomes so much more important to them than on a day-by-day basis what the Israelis do. That's not to say that the geopolitical situation here does not entwine them with the Israelis, but on a day-by-day basis, it's just them and all the other Palestinians around them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure, Terry.
Matt Beinan-Reese spoke to us from Jerusalem. He's the author of the new detective novel, The Collaborator of Bethlehem. He was Time Magazine's Jerusalem bureau chief from 2000 to 2006 and is now a contributor to the magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bristol Bay Productions, presenting Amazing Grace, based on the true story and song behind the abolition of the British slave trade, opens February 23rd. From TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at TIAACREF.org. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, he was a double agent in Alias, starred in the series Justice, and on Broadway originated the role of the sailor in Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. We talk with Victor Garber. He just starred in a revival of Sondheim's Follies, staged by the City Center Encore series in New York. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen Sondheim's 1971 musical Follies was just revived by the New York City Center Encore series, which stages concert versions of musicals for very brief runs. My guest Victor Garber starred in the Encore's production of Follies, which ran from February 8th through 11th, but there's talk about moving it to Broadway. Garber was also in the original productions of Sondheim's Sweeney Todd and Assassins. On TV, he starred in Alias as a spy who's the father of a spy, played by Jennifer Garner. The series ended last year, a year in which Garber also starred in the courtroom series Justice. His movies include Titanic, Legally Blonde, and Exotica. I spoke with Victor Garber Tuesday, the day after Follies closed. Victor Garber, welcome to Fresh Air. The Encore series is a series of concert productions, which means sometimes the actors actually carry scripts in their hand. There's no real sets. Costumes are very simple. How is it different for you as an actor?
Well, I saw an Encores years ago, and they were much more, they've become much more elaborate in the last few years. And the book, you actually are required to hold the book by law, of equity law, because it is a reading. It is called a staged reading. But they have become so
Wait. Does that explain why you had the script in the first part when you walked on and then didn't have it the rest of the time?
No, I had it the whole time.
Oh, I stopped noticing.
Well, that's what happens. Okay. The only time I didn't have it is the very final number. But I was a stickler for holding the script because some of the actors, the other actors, you know, closed their book during the scenes. I always had it there just in case.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
I in fact, did have to look down a few times. But, you know, we only have 10 days rehearsal, so it's kind of insane. It's kind of like I would think it's like what summer stock was like, you know, which I've never done, but you know, where you rehearse for, you know, a week and then put on a show, and it's literally everyone is in a sort of a blind panic backstage, and then you just go out there and you can't believe you're in front of people in such a short time, but it's that is also exhilarating. And the great part for me is that, you know, you only do it six times and then you don't have to do it anymore, because I kind of like that aspect of it. It's the 8-show-a-week thing for a long time that I've grown to. It's harder for me as I've gotten older.
Do you not like repeating the same character, the same lines over and over?
No, actually,
over a very extended time.
No, I actually don't mind that. For me, it's the musical, it's singing, because particularly Sondheim, you know, you have to be in flawless voice. You mm-hmm. can't sort of, you know, sing through Too Many Mornings. You have to really be in you know, great shape. And for it's just you know, one little, you know, phlegm ball and it's ruined. And it's very stressful. You know, I found it very stressful.
Now, there's a song in Follies in which your character does his version of a top hat, white tie, and tail song, and he actually, you know, has one of those dancing canes, and he's singing right. about how his creed is live, laugh, and love. But in the middle of the song, when I saw it, and don't interrupt me while I ask you this question.
Okay.
In the middle of the song, when I saw it, you dropped your cane, and then you were so rattled you forgot a few of your lines, and I was so nervous for you, and I thought, should I bring this up in the interview or will it be embarrassing? And of course, a split second later, I realized, no, your character's having a breakdown and your character dropped the cane and your character is forgetting his lines and it's all kind of scripted in. But because I'd never seen Follies before, like, you really had me, and I felt so bad for you.
Well, thank you. I think thank you. No, it's interesting because a lot of my friends came last night. We closed last night, and several of them were, and they'd actually seen Follies, and they'd forgotten that that's what happens. And so many people have mentioned that, and it's one of those great opportunities to you know, fake the audience, and it's, you know, also what makes live theater so thrilling, because the possibility is I have dropped the cane and I have forgotten the lyrics, and but in fact it's all staged.
When did you first see Follies, and what did it mean to you?
Well, actually, I saw the original. Of course, I was a child, but I saw it in New York. In, I think it was 72. I can't, but it was in the early 70s, and I just got a single ticket for, and I sat in the front row of the theater. I think it was the Winter Garden Theater, and it was a dazzling experience because, first of all, you know, for me, Sondheim, Sondheim sort of is the reason I really became an actor. His music. I heard Anyone Can Whistle when I was very young. I was living in Toronto at the time, and this friend of mine played me this score, and it was sort of like I've said this before, but it's true. It was sort of like a siren call for me to come to New York. It was what really intrigued me about musical theater. And because up until that point, I hadn't really, you know, I mean, I loved, you know, I loved Carousel. I loved The King and I was in them when I was a kid. But this music and these lyrics were so struck a chord in me that I'd never experienced. And that's kind of so that's really one of the reasons I wanted to come to New York. And Follies, of course, was playing, and I had to see it. So that was my first Sondheim show that I saw.
And then just a few years later, you were cast in the original production of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd in the role of Anthony, the sailor.
Yes.
It must have been overwhelming for you to have come to New York in part because of a Sondheim musical and then end up in a Sondheim musical.
It was truly an extraordinary experience for me because I went into the audition, and I think I was studying voice with a teacher who, you know, I think I sang some, you know, Italian art song, not terribly well, because I'm not really classically trained. And but there was something, and I what was really terrifying was that everybody, all the other guys who were auditioning, all sounded like, you know, they just had these phenomenal voices, and I was very intimidated. But they saw something in me. I don't know whether it was just I was green, but that they thought was right for the character. And so they asked me if I would learn a song from the show and then come back and audition with the song. And I said, yeah, I would. And the next thing I knew, I was on a bus going down Second Avenue to Stephen Sondheim's house, which was like, it was surreal, frankly. And, you know, he answered the door, and I walked in and went up to the second floor where his study is and where his piano is, and then he sat down at the piano, and I put on my little tape recorder and my little cassette. You know, in those days, that's what we used, and he struck the first chords of Joanna, and sang into my tape recorder the song Joanna, which, you know, of course, people now know, and I just thought, well, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. And I went home and learned it because I don't read music, and so I had to learn it just, you know, by ear, and then I went in and sang it and got the part, and I wish I still had that cassette, but I of course lost it somewhere along the line.
You're a great cassette to have.
It would be something.
Well, we should listen to you singing Joanna from the original cast recording of Sweeney Todd. And this is the song you sing when you've fallen in love with a beautiful young woman, but she's the ward of a very mean judge who has done all kinds of cruel things that I won't go into. And so this is Victor Garber from the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd.
I feel you, Joanna. I feel you. I was half convinced I'd waken, satisfied enough to dream you. Happily, I was mistaken, Joanna. I'll steal you, Joanna. I'll steal you. Do they think that walls can hide you? Even now I'm at your window. I am in the dark beside you, buried sweetly in your yellow hair. I'm with you then, I'm with you there, sweetly buried in your yellow hair.
Nick DeGarber, it must have been so thrilling when the music is like swelling behind you and you're singing this song.
Yeah, it, when I think back to those days, I was young and sort of inexperienced, and I didn't really, really appreciate it until I went back to see the show. After I had left the show, I actually left after 6 months, or I was one of the first to leave because, frankly, I was, I forget how old I was, but I wanted to play sort of older people. I felt the character of Anthony at that time was, I just couldn't muster up the naivete anymore. I just sort of felt like I had couldn't do it. And so I finished the run for my contract. And then I went back when Angela Lansbury and Len Carrier were about to leave. And I just went, I just took some friends and we went back to see the show. And I realized as I was sitting there what I had been in. You know, it was sort of like, because when you're in it, you don't really, you obviously can't see it. And I mean, I knew the score was extraordinary and I knew the people in it were extraordinary. But to see it, in, you know, from an audience perspective was truly memorable. And I thought, wow, I wish I had known that more when I was doing it.
My guest is Victor Garber. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Victor Garber. He starred in the TV series Alias, was in the films Titanic, Legally Blonde, and Exotica, was in the original productions of Sondheim's Sweeney Todd and Assassins, and just starred in a revival of Sondheim's Follies. It's funny, it's almost as if you have two or maybe three different careers, because there's the career you have on stage and, you know, in musicals and dramas. And people who follow theater really know you for that. And then there's the career you've had in movies and the career you've had on television where, you're really famous for Alias.
Oh,
in
really?
In which, you know, you played the father of Jennifer Garner, and you're both, like, double agents who it's always really confusing who you're working for.
Oh, you think it was confusing to me, too.
I was going to ask you if it was confusing to you.
And
always sure which side you were working for.
I never knew. It was a joke often. I say, now, what am I doing now? Who am I? Am I for this or against this? You know, it's like, we would laugh a lot about it. But listen, for me, being an actor was always about doing different things. That, to me, signified what an actor was. And I was so grateful that I never got slotted into just one thing, be it, you know, musicals, drama, whatever. I just, you know, the first thing I did in New York was Ghosts at the Roundabout Theater when it was, you know, under a supermarket in Chelsea, and then I got to do and Godspell as the movie, the musical. So I had already, you know, basically done different things, and so I just felt so fortunate that I was never typed, because that to me would be kind of a death sentence. I would go mad if I had to sort of do the same thing all the time.
How did you get the part in Alias? What was the audition like? And I mean, how did you even know that there was an audition?
Well, I had, I'd been sort of reading pilot scripts for a few years because I was interested in possibly doing something like that. And the script came to my attention, and I read it, and I thought it was one of the best scripts I'd read. J.J. Abrams had written this pilot, and I read the first scene that my character had in the pilot, which was a phone conversation with his would-be son-in-law, and he basically he sort of dismisses him in a really cold and sarcastic and extremely, to my way of thinking, funny way. And that's, I said, okay, I want to do this. And that was really, that scene is what did it. And so I called my agent, and they said, oh, well, at that time they were interested in all these big stars. And I said, well, fine, if they ever get down to it, call me and I'll audition. And, you know, and I got the job. I mean, it was really, I went after it, and I was really happy to get it because I thought the script was so good. And then, you know, 5 years later, we finished.
Well, I want to play that scene that you just mentioned that made you want to do this series. And
really?
In this scene, oh. This is from the first episode, and in this scene, the man who has just proposed to your daughter, played by Jennifer Garner, and she's accepted, so now her fiancé is calling you up to ask you for her hand in marriage. And here's the scene.
Yeah.
Oh, Mr. Bristow.
Yes.
Hi, it's Danny Hecht.
Sydney's boyfriend.
Is Sydney all right?
Oh, yeah.
She's fine. Nothing to worry about. I'm calling because I'm planning on asking Sydney to marry me.
And I was hoping to get your approval.
Danny, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
How well do you know my daughter?
We've been dating for 2 years.
Because if you feel the need to ask me about this scenario, I have a sense you don't know Sydney at all.
So I love your daughter, and I want to marry her. That's why I'm calling.
First of all, Danny, the truth is, this is just a courtesy call. Like when you say to your neighbor, we're having a loud party on Saturday night, if that's all right with you. What you really mean is, we're having a loud party on Saturday night.
Mr. Bristow.
Sydney doesn't give a damn what my opinion is. What interests me is that you do.
It's just a custom to call the father. That's all this is.
Well, then, I'll tell you what. I may become your father-in-law, and that's just fine. But I will not be used as part of a charming little anecdote you tell your friends at cocktail parties so they can see what a quaint, old-fashioned guy Danny really is. Are we clear?
Yes, sir.
Good. Then welcome to the family.
That's Victor Garber in the first episode of Alias. Now, you grew up in Canada. In Toronto?
Well, I grew up, outside of Toronto and then started my career in my teens in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read that your mother was an actress and singer. What kind of performances, what kind of work did she have?
She had a talk show in London, Ontario, where I was born, and her name was Hope Garber. And it was called At Home with Hope Garber, which was ironic because she was the worst housekeeper. imaginable, but she was very glamorous and she had a lovely quality, and she was sort of a celebrity in our town. I mean, people knew who she was, and she would do she also had a beautiful singing voice, and she would do, when she was younger, she was a band singer, and then as she got older, she would do these occasional benefits and fashion shows, and she would sing, and she did that while I was growing up. And then when my parents separated, she moved to Toronto, and then eventually she moved to L.A. and she pursued her acting career then. But she really didn't do very well, and she would get occasional, you know, one line in a sitcom or, you know. But she worked, you know. She did stuff, and it was her kind of her dream to be on television and be in movies, and she did it a little bit.
My guest is Victor Garber. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Victor Garber. He starred in the TV series Alias, was in the films Titanic, Legally Blonde, and Exotica, was in the original productions of Sondheim's Sweeney Todd and Assassins, and just starred in a revival of Sondheim's Follies. Your first movie role was playing Jesus in Godspell.
Yeah.
The movie, yes.
Yes.
And I think you'd been in the stage production in Canada before that.
Yes, I was cast in the Toronto production. You know, the director was sort of touring, seeing at that time there were like 10 or 12 companies of Godspell that had settled in different cities, and we were the Canadian version. And I think we were the last one he saw. And then he was there opening night, and then I read in the paper the next day or the day after that he was going to cast me in the movie. That's how I heard I was going to do it, and it was kind of, you know, an amazing thing. And that's the famous cast, you know, Marty Short, Andrea Martin, Gilda Radner, Eugene Levy. Paul Schaefer was the musical director. It was
the stage production you're talking about.
It was the stage production, yeah. Yes. So that's when all of that started, and then I went to New York to do the movie.
Have you seen the movie lately?
Well, I can't possibly watch it.
Oh, is it dated looking?
Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't. There are, you know, it has its fans, and I'm very happy about that. But no, it's a. It's not something I could sit through. But we did Dance on the World Trade Center. That was a phenomenal thing that happened. That I, it really was only after like 2 days after the buildings came down that I realized that I had danced on top of it. It didn't dawn on me until, you know, a couple of days afterwards. But it was an amazing experience.
We were dancing on like in one of those balconies on the top of the building, or what?
It was before the buildings were finished, and we took the elevator up to the top as far as it would go. I can't remember which building it was, but they were not finished and they were not occupied yet. And we climbed scaffolding and ladders to get to the top, and then there was a helicopter shot that went along the side. It was the very end of All for the Best, and the whole dance and song sequence was, you know, we were at Lincoln Center, we were at all these different landmarks. We danced in front of the Accutron sign as the Accutron mimicked what we were doing. It's kind of a great number, and then it ends with, you know, yes, it's all for the best, and we're dancing on top of the World Trade Center.
You were in a TV production of Annie. That's really good.
Thanks.
It's you and Alan Cumming. And
Kathy Bates?
Yeah, Kathy Bates.
Audra McDonald.
Oh, yeah, Audra McDonald.
Kristen Chenoweth. Mm-hmm, yeah, it's a really good cast.
I don't imagine you've done other Annies, but what was it like doing it for the camera, like doing a musical for the camera as opposed to doing it on stage?
Well, I loved it. First of all, Rob Marshall directed it, you know, and he went on to direct Chicago.
Chicago, the movie version.
But Annie was his first first movie that he directed and choreographed. He had choreographed for television Cinderella, which I had also done with him. But then Annie, he called me and said, "Would I play Daddy Warbucks?" And I thought he was insane. I'd never seen the show. I didn't know anything about it really, other than I knew that song, of course. And he convinced me that it would be great, and it turned out to be one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done. And I love the fact that, you know, when like crew members on the shows that I've worked on will come up and say, "Oh, my kids, you know, loved you and Annie," and it was like, it's so sweet that mm-hmm. you know, when they meet me, they know that's Daddy Warbucks. And it's for me, you know, it's different only in that it's just a more intimate kind of setting for acting. You still have to get to the core of what you're saying and what you're doing, and then the truth of what's going on in the scene. So it's just, in a way, it's easier because you just have that intimacy, and of course it's pre-recorded, so you don't have to do it 8 times, and it's the songs, and so for me, I loved it. I loved the experience of doing it for TV.
Just one more thing. You told us before that after playing the sailor Anthony in Sweeney Todd, you felt like you needed out after a while because you just couldn't play that naive anymore.
Yeah.
But now in your career, you're playing so many cynical people. Like even in Follies, like your character, he's a pretty cynical character. And of course, in Alias, you're this like double agent who's, you know, never really revealing emotion. And Do you feel, you know, and then in the TV series that you were in Justice, you're, you know, like a manipulative lawyer.
Hideous, yes.
Yeah, so do you feel like you've gone to the other end now?
Well, first of all, it's more fun to play. You know, it's always more fun to play. But the for me, you know, why they're fun to play is because they're that way for a reason. They come from a place either of pain or a flawed core that makes them turn into these arrogant idiots or cynical people. It's where they come from that makes it interesting to play, because then you get to hopefully see the cracks. And that's what I try to do, even with Jack Bristow. You know, his love for his daughter was overwhelming, and he just couldn't express it. But every now and then you'd see a hint of it, or you'd get a glimpse of it in their relationship. And that was what made him dimensional, hopefully. And so anytime I play a character like that, it's hopefully to, you know, make it dimensional and three-dimensional, and you see the other side and how they got to be that way. And that's what was so great about Ben Stone and Follies, because, you know, the last part, the last number is when you see it all unravel.
Well, Victor Garber, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Victor Garber was just in a New York City Center Encores production of Stephen Sondheim's Follies. The Encores series continues this spring with Irving Berlin's Face the Music and an original review called Stairway to Paradise. We'll close with Victor Garber from the soundtrack of the TV production of Annie. I'm Terry Gross.
You know what, Annie?
What?
I think I'm the luckiest man in the world.
And I think I'm the luckiest kid.
Together at last, together forever, we're tying a knot they never can sever.
I don't need sunshine now to turn my skies to blue.
I don't need anything but you.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, with a Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. From Warner Home Video, presenting The Departed on DVD and high definition, including two documentaries on a two-disc set available today. And from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Clint Eastwood talks about making his film Letters from Iwo Jima. It has Oscar nominations for Best Picture and Best Director. And his companion film, Flags of Our Fathers, is nominated for two Oscars. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.